Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jack Brighton, and Brian Wagner, is at the controls this morning. Before we begin this hour, just a very quick mention that on Monday, we'll be talking with Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program each month, and we talk about home maintenance. He knows a lot about the way single-family homes are put together and some of the things that can go wrong. So if you have a problem, you're thinking about making some changes, you need some advice, he can help. Then in the second hour, we'll be talking a little bit about what a lot of folks consider to be the golden age of radio. And our guest will be Gerald Nachman. He has spent a long time as a theater film critic, mostly in newspapers, and he's written a book titled Raised on Radio, which in part reflects some of his childhood experiences where there was the day when instead of everyone gathering around the television set, everyone gathered around the radio. And we'll talk about some of the programs that were important there in those days and how they went on to influence American culture. So that will be Monday. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you each week, and we always offer the opportunity to call in with questions, comments. And we'd also like to mention that we are now and have for some time now been on the web 24 hours a day. In fact, if you would like to listen through your computer, you may do that. And for some folks, particularly at night, that's the way to do it now. www.will.uiuc.edu. That's our website. You just go right there. It'll give you all the information that you need to know. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about some of the experiences of a judge working in a large urban court. We're talking here this morning with Eugene Hamilton, who has just recently retired as chief judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. He is, however, in senior status now on the court and does continue to hear cases. He is here on the campus to be honored by the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences for his achievements. And in fact, he is a graduate of the University of Illinois, has a bachelor's degree in political science, and also went to law school here. He was nominated by President Richard Nixon to be an associate judge of the Superior Court in D.C. He was confirmed by the Senate and was appointed associate judge in 1970, and served continuously on the court since then. In October of 1993, he was named the chief judge of the court for a term of 4 years, and then was reappointed for a second term in October of 1997. As I mentioned, just has retired as chief judge, but continues to serve there on the court. And he's been good enough to come and give us some of his time while he is back here visiting his alma mater, and we're pleased that he's here.
Pleased to be here, David. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And I should also mention the telephone number, too, for people who would like to call in, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At what point did you decide or start thinking about being a, in your career, did you start thinking about being a judge?
Well, back in 1970, in the District of Columbia, we had a very backlogged court, and to address that backlog, President Nixon decided to go to Congress and ask for an expansion in the number of judges who were appointed to that court. I was in the Justice Department at that time, and I did some work on the preliminary legislation for the expansion of the court, and after that work had been done and the legislation had been passed, and President Nixon was given the task of appointing some new judges, some 10 or 15 new judges, the thought occurred to me that perhaps it would be nice to go to the court now and do some work in the court. And I just mentioned that in passing to then Attorney General John Mitchell. And a couple of weeks later, I was called by the White House and told by President Nixon that he intended to nominate me.
I don't know if that I'm, well, I would imagine that every lawyer does not aspire to be a judge. Some would just as soon stay on that side of the bench. What sort of things influenced your decision and in your interest in taking on a different sort of role?
Well, one of the things that was very, very backlogged at that time, David, was the juvenile docket. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of juvenile cases that had not been reached and disposed of. I mean, many, many juvenile cases. And most people think that, well, why be concerned about the non-adjudication of juvenile cases? Well, the point is there are a lot of juveniles who are awaiting adjudication that need help and need various interventions and treatments and programs to take them off of that juvenile delinquency track. And with those cases not being adjudicated, those children were not getting that help that they needed. And that was really the thing that really concerned me. We had, when I went on the bench, over 5,000 unadjudicated juvenile cases involving 5,000 juveniles who really needed, whether they were guilty or not guilty, they still needed some type of intervention and help to take them off of that juvenile track. And that was a tremendous challenge. I went to the bench and I assisted in adjudicating those cases. And I sort of fell in love with the juvenile work at that time.
Yeah. You certainly have been credited with introducing a number of different programs there in D.C. That seem to be trying to get at underlying issues, domestic and family issues, drug issues, for example, with the idea that unless you really deal with those, then you may well find yourself with these same people in front of you over and over again. Just for example, drug courts. You instituted drug courts for both adults and for juveniles. Why was it you thought that was a particular issue that needed a special emphasis?
Well, substance abuse is one of the, if not the leading cause of both juvenile delinquency and adult criminal behavior. And if we can address that substance dependence and abuse at the front end rather than the back end, we can actually cut off a large number of people who would otherwise come into the court. And so the point and object of both the juvenile and adult drug court is to get those people, when they come to the court and their primary problem is substance abuse or substance use, to give them the treatment, to force them through the judicial mandate, and that's a powerful mandate, to force those people into treatment to keep them from coming back, to get them off of that substance abuse and substance dependence, which leads to that criminality, to keep them from coming back. And so we reduce the number of cases that we have to deal with by reducing the number of people who are substance dependent. And so we attack the backlog from the front end rather than from the back end.
It seems to be a place, though, where some people would argue that we don't put nearly as many resources in that as we should. There is, particularly in correctional facilities, and we've cut back a lot on the money that's available for providing drug treatment for people who are in prison, but also these other kinds of programs that are diversionary in nature that we hope will keep people from getting in serious trouble, that aren't funded at the level that they should, and there are a lot of people who need help for whom help's just not available.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I have found in being chief judge and trying to get a lot of these programs started that you get the greatest amount of assistance in overcoming that reluctance to put the funds in at the front end from the most unlikely source, and that is from the police, because they, more than anyone else, understand this revolving door type. They see the same people over and over and over again. You arrest them today, they're released, they're back the next day, and so forth. And the same problem is there, substance abuse or substance use. So you go to the police and you ask for their assistance, and they give it to you to get the necessary funds to institute these programs.
Hmm. So the adult drug court, the juvenile drug court, were indeed successful, have been successful?
Yes, very, very successful. Because it does cut off this revolving door type situation where people just keep coming back time and time again unless you treat the underlying cause of that criminality. You don't prevent a person from using and abusing drugs simply by arresting them, prosecuting them and incarcerating them, because you leave intact the underlying reason and motive for their being there in the first place. Now, if you treat that substance use, then and only then can you cut it off.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eugene Hamilton. He is just recently retired as Chief Judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. He is now retired in senior status. That means he's still working and is still hearing cases. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, went to undergraduate school here and law school, and is here visiting the campus. He's being honored by the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences for his work as a judge. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Also, one of the things that you did was you established a domestic violence court.
Yes.
What was the idea there?
Well, the idea there is that domestic violence, like substance abuse, grows out of some underlying problems that need to be addressed. Now, true, you have to protect people who have been battered in domestic violence. But over and above that, you have to treat the cause of the violence which has been exhibited by one of the partners in the relationship against the other. So we put in a very, very proactive program which required people who have been found guilty of domestic violent acts to submit themselves to psychological analysis, psychological treatment, and treatment which address their tendency to express their frustrations against their domestic partner in a violent way. This not only protected the battered person, but it also increased the likelihood that families could be kept intact for the benefit and support of any of the children that may have been a part of that domestic relationship.
What strikes me is that here it gives us an opportunity to talk about how it is in this country we talk about crime and punishment and prevention, and that there often are extreme points of view, one extreme being that if people commit crimes, we simply should punish them as severely as we possibly can. That's what the law is about. And so when we look at the resources that we have to allocate, what we should be doing primarily is spending that on police officers and hiring just as many police officers as we can, certainly as many as we need, and then arresting people. And if they're guilty, convicting them. And if they are convicted, putting them in jail. And if that if the numbers continue to grow and that means we have to build more prisons, well, that we're going to do that. On the other hand, there are people who make this argument that says that's really not a very good way to deal with crime because it's dealing with it after the fact, and that what we really ought to do is look at crime as a social matter, as a social issue, and look at what's going on in the lives of people who are committing crimes and trying to understand, is there something that we could do as a society to make it less likely that they're going to be involved in criminal activity? It seems as though the difficulty here is that this conversation, first of all, it becomes highly politicized, and that then in the time where we seem to be, people seem much more sympathetic to the punishment idea than the prevention idea.
Well, you're absolutely right, David. And of course, I found that dilemma very prevalent as I thought about these various prevention programs. But here again, I think what has been happening in the past is all of the people in the criminal justice community have not been talking to each other, have not been cooperating with each other, have not been trying really in a very collaborative way to address the same problem. Each has been operating in their own little area and trying to protect that little area by getting as much of the resource pie, the dollars, if you will, as each possibly could. So one of the things that I did with the other members of the criminal justice community in the District of Columbia was to set up what we call the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, where all of the members of the criminal justice, the police, the prosecutors, the corrections, the probation, the parole, we all sat down around the same table and addressed the same problem at the same time and decided what resources were needed on the front end, what resources were needed in the middle, and what resources were needed at the end in the penal system and the probation systems and so forth, so that we had a coordinated approach to the criminal and juvenile delinquency problems in the District of Columbia. And I think that has been going on around the country. And take all this politics out. Take all of this turf protection. Take all of this finger-pointing out. And sit down and share experiences, share knowledge, share concerns, and arrive at a coordinated solution to the criminal justice problems. Now, in domestic violence, for example, we had a very high homicide rate arising out of domestic situations in the district. I mean, it was just absolutely phenomenal. And after we sat down with all of the members of the criminal justice community, the police, the social workers, parole, corrections, and so forth, we concentrated on this domestic violence homicide problem, and we brought that problem down, I mean, absolutely significantly. In the first year of the operation of the domestic violence, coordinated domestic violence program, which included the domestic violence court, that was not the only part of it. That was just one part of it. The police had a domestic violence program. Probation had a domestic, the corrections had a domestic. We all put our resources together. And the first year of the operation of that program, we virtually eliminated any domestic homicides in the District of Columbia where a husband or a boyfriend or a wife or a girlfriend had killed the other.
It strikes me that it still must be difficult, even if you get all the people who are involved in the criminal justice system to sit down and talk about where they think resources should be allocated, that then you still have to, at some point, you have to go to some legislative body and get them to allocate. They're the ones that have to provide the money. And it still seems that it's often more appealing to be able to say to your constituents, I am tough on crime. I'm going to put those criminals behind bars where they belong. We're going to put more police on the streets and that sort of thing. And then it's easier, more appealing to do that than to say, I really think that we ought to put more resources into providing drug treatment and to providing counseling for people who have been violent and that sort of thing. It's just, unfortunately, that seems to be the case.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that we have to constantly strive to try to overcome, and that is the tendency sometimes on the part of our politicians to politicize the criminal justice system by trying to point to the fact that they've put more police on the street and more people have been arrested and more people may have even been convicted. But that's not the solution, the complete solution to the criminal justice problem. Mm-hmm. And it is an ongoing struggle to try to get that message out. But believe me, the greatest allies in striking the death blow to those types of arguments are the police themselves. And I have found them to be tremendous allies in overhauling the entire criminal justice system.
Yeah. I remember some years ago, a brief interview with the man who at the time was the chief of police for the city of Champaign, who himself has recently retired. And one of my colleagues was talking to him about crime prevention and asked a question, just something to the effect of, well, what do you think that we could do to eliminate crime? And his comment was, well, I think we should be spending more money on Head Start. And my colleague said he'd almost fell over because he was so surprised by an answer like that. And this was Don Carter, who was the chief of police there. And I think a lot of people respected him for a number of reasons, but that was one, that he recognized that if you didn't deal with sort of infrastructure issues,
right,
that you could have all nearly all the police officers in the world, and that really wouldn't quite get at it.
And you still wouldn't have enough.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that message is really getting out in the law enforcement community. And I think that realization has been one of the real major factors in reducing nationwide the crime that we have seen across the country, because I think the police, more so, as I said, than anyone else, understand that you reduce crime most efficiently and effectively by preventing it.
Yeah. We have seen reductions in recent years in levels of violent crime in the United States, and I think that different people, depending on what their agendas are, might want to lay claim to that.
Yes.
And it may indeed be a difficult question to answer why it is that has happened. But from your perspective, what do you think have been the most important factors that have contributed to this decrease that we've seen?
Okay. Well, I think, first of all, we have programs out there like the Juvenile and Adult Drug Court, like the Domestic Violence Court, and other programs like that have really made a substantial impact in the number of people that are recycling in the system. And by reducing that number of people that are recycling, I think we have eliminated the need for a lot of these people to graduate from the nonviolent crimes to the violent crime. Because you take a substance abuser who stays in the system long enough, they may be nonviolent when they start off, but as they progress along the prosecution, conviction, prosecution, conviction track, they become increasingly frustrated, increasingly hardened, and increasingly violent. If you cut that off, I think you cut off the stream of individuals that would otherwise be going into the commission of violent crime. Secondly, I think with the cooperation between the police on the one hand and the courts on the other hand and probation and parole on the other hand and so forth, you have a greater exchange of information. And this exchange of information permits more efficient, more effective law enforcement. And with more efficient, effective law enforcement, that really suppresses the amount of crime that's being committed also in the community. So with these agencies sitting down, talking to each other, sharing information with each other, listening to each other, addressing the same concerns at the same time from different points of view, not just from one point, not just from prevention or treatment, but from apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and so forth. From all of those points of view, with that type of cooperation, I think it's teamed up to really effectively and efficiently reduce crime in the community. Hmm.
We have a caller here and would welcome others. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And again, I should introduce our guest. We're speaking with Eugene Hamilton. He is a retired chief judge in senior status of the Superior Court in the District of Columbia, and has been on the court, as I mentioned, for a number of years. He was nominated to serve by President Nixon and was confirmed by the Senate and was appointed an associate judge in 1970 and then was named the chief judge in 1993 for a term of 4 years and then was reappointed. And he just, within the past couple of weeks, has retired as chief judge but continues to be a judge and continues to hear cases. And as I mentioned, also, he's a graduate of the University of Illinois. He's here to be honored by the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, along with some other alums. Questions again, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The caller here is in Urbana on line one.
What disturbs me about the criminal justice system is the Vietnam mentality of the drug laws. As the Channel 37 on cable last night pointed out, that drug offenders are taking up the spaces and serve longer, in many cases, serve longer sentences than rapists or murderers. Now, there are tens of thousands of citizens in the United States who had no criminal intent whatsoever, All they wanted to do was to get high, and yet they are behind bars. And I think that is ridiculous. It's a holdover from the Nixon mentality, and it's ruining lives, maybe not as violently and as terribly as the Vietnam War, but it's the same mentality.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that was the old theory about substance users and substance abusers, but I think the modern day theory is that we waste too much time and money and effort on just simply warehousing people whose only problem really is substance abuse or substance dependency. Now the criminal justice system has recognized that, and what we're trying to do is funnel all of those cases to which you have just referred, which involve people, as you say, who simply wanted to get high. I mean, that's the only thing that they really were interested in. We are sending those people now through the drug courts, and believe you me, the moving force in the drug court is treatment and prevention. So you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you for your pragmatic consideration. I would like to add one more point. In Genesis, first chapter, 28 through 31, it talks about, I have given thee, God is speaking, he's saying, I have given thee every green herb for meat, to every beast of the earth, to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, I have given thee herb for sustenance, and the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And I think it's ridiculous for the criminal justice system to vie with God for that.
Well, I think you're right. Thank you very much.
All right. And other questions, comments are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Official law enforcement officials in New York City have gotten a lot of attention in recent years for an approach to law enforcement there that I think they believe, perhaps other people believed, has really helped lower the rate of crime in New York, an approach that says we ought to pay as much attention, maybe even more attention, to really minor low-level crimes, things like petty theft, vandalism, vagrancy. People might want to take exception even to the use of a word like that. But that's that sort of thing, that we really ought to be paying as much attention to the guy who jumps the turnstile at the subway as somebody perhaps who is committing a higher level crime. The idea being that by doing that and making the city a sort of a more civilized place to live in, that has an effect on also the commission of more serious crime. And I wonder what you think of that idea.
Well, I think that idea has a lot of merit to it. I think there are a lot of violent, more serious crimes that are committed eventually by people who are involved in these minor quality of life crimes like turnstile jumping, urinating in public, drinking in public, etc. So that if you pay a lot of attention to these quality of life crimes, I think you do prevent those individuals graduating into the more serious violent crime. And I think that's what happened in New York, and I think that's what has been happening to some extent across the country. The caveat is that when you pay a lot of attention to these minor quality of life crimes, you have to understand and realize that your major point and objective in paying a lot of attention is not to penalize those people, but to treat those people, to diagnose those people, to determine what their underlying problem is, and treat that underlying problem rather than just trying to punish those people. Most of those individuals who are engaged in that quality of life crime are individuals who are either alcoholics or people who have mental problems, or both. And your system has to be prepared to recognize that and address and treat these underlying problems. I think the city of New York has done that. I think other places in the country have done it. We've done it in the District of Columbia, and that is a lesson that we overlooked for a long period of time, but it is a lesson that we're now aware of.
Yeah, I guess there you certainly touch on what is, for in some people's minds, the flip side of this, and that is that what this kind of approach may, the fear is that what we're going to turn into is a program that ends up harassing people who are not committing serious crimes, and that maybe that we would question, is that the right way to allocate resources?
Well, I think if you don't address these underlying problems, you are subject to that very legitimate criticism, is that you're just basically harassing a whole lot of people for no good reason and with no good result. And so that's another reason why it's very important that you have this treatment prevention aspect as a part of that. In New York, for example, they have what they call the community court in Manhattan, which is composed of specially trained judges who have a great deal of understanding in dealing with the people who are perpetrating these quality of life crimes. They're very much attuned to treatment, to diagnosis, and so forth.
We have someone else to talk with. This is Clinton, Indiana. It's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes.
I don't want to be one of your freaking callers, but I was interested in this last feller's call about, you know, that, you know, God said, you know, you're, you know, all this stuff, you're welcome to everything on the earth and all, whatever. Just not 3 blocks from here, a couple years ago, 2 young fellas I knew they weren't smoking pot, I don't believe. They were on to something else and boozing and whatever, and killed 2 young girls. They strangled them. And then, consequently, one of them was put away for life, and the other's not quite so long because he said he couldn't remember. But that's in response to the other fellow's call.
Well, I don't think the lesson is lost on anyone that the use of mind-altering and mood-altering drugs is not something to be encouraged or tolerated by anyone. And at any time you have a situation where people are using mind or mood-altering drugs, you have a problem that needs to be addressed. Substance use is just as much a problem as substance abuse, and these matters should be addressed in the criminal justice system, but they should be addressed with a coordinated effort from both the law enforcement and the treatment communities.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions, comments, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think we've certainly also seen fairly recent, last couple of years, concerns about the use of deadly force by police officers. There have been some big city cases that got a lot of attention in the national media, but it's certainly not simply a big city issue. Happens in Champaign too, as a matter. Yes, indeed it does. It's the kind of thing that does happen everywhere. Particularly, I think there has been some concern about some big city police departments and their methods employed by plainclothes street crimes units. And some people are really concerned that some cases these officers may be adopting the methods of the people that they're trying to go after. Generally, what do you think about this question and how we approach the idea of use of deadly force?
Well, the use of deadly force by law enforcement agencies is a very, very serious matter. First of all, police officers, just like anyone else, and perhaps more so than anyone else, have to be subjected to intensive, good quality training. And a part of that training is when and how and to what extent deadly force should be used. This is very, very important. And you find a police department who has not learned that lesson, and you're going to have a lot of trouble. case in point is the Metropolitan Police Department in the District of Columbia. Last year, we had a very, very high rate of officers using deadly force through the use of deadly weapons, usually pistols, as a result of which many people have been killed, an inordinately large number of people have been killed. And the reason for that is that training had gone unattended for such a long period of time. And police officers were put in situations where they were very confused about when and to what extent and how to use deadly force. And as a consequence, I would venture the guess that they were using deadly force too frequently. So training is the first answer to that problem. Secondly, independent, objective investigation. And I was noting in the paper this morning that I read about the Champaign incident. Mm-hmm. Where that incident is being investigated by an independent agency, I believe the Urbana Police Department. And I think good, objective, independent investigation, each time you have the use by a police officer of deadly force, is very, very important. Number one, it creates an atmosphere within the police department which tells police officers that there is accountability for their behavior. Secondly, it creates an atmosphere of credibility on the part of the police department in the community. And the police department, like the courts, cannot operate effectively in the community without credibility in the community. Hmm.
This gets us to maybe another issue that we might talk about that's getting a lot of attention nationally, and that is racial profiling.
Yes.
And gets to this very issue when a police officer goes out on the street, he or she is looking around and thinking, who am I dealing with here? Who should I be concerned about? Is it possible for me to look and look all around and pick somebody and say, now this is a person that deserves watching more than anybody else? It seems that to a great extent here now, race and racial issues shape, distort relationships between law enforcement and citizens. What do we do about that?
Well, here again, police officers, like other people, but particularly police officers, because they have so much power and they can wield so much power, just in the batting of an eyelash, they have to be trained that you cannot make good, solid decisions simply based upon a person's race or ethnic background. That tells you little or nothing about that person as an individual. So this is one of the things that you just have to shut your mind to. I mean, I can't pick out a culprit anywhere just simply based upon what an individual's race is or is not. Because if you do that, you're likely to make some terrible mistakes about who you pick for this or who you pick for that. Race just bears no relationship generally to law enforcement, and police officers just have to be taught that. Put this out of your mind. Don't let it influence your judgment at all.
Hmm. This is an issue that has come up in the presidential race, and both of the candidates have talked about this, and the subject of legislation has been raised. Some people think that the Congress should pass a law banning racial profiling. And I guess the thing I wonder about is that we may do that, but by passing a law, can you actually eliminate racial profiling? Is that something you can do legislatively?
No, I don't think so. I don't think passing a law to ban racial profiling is the effective, efficient way to deal with racial profiling. I think the appropriation of money to train law enforcement officers to put race out of your mind and when you make decisions in law enforcement is a more efficient, effective way to go about it. And I would like to see some appropriations to train local police departments to eliminate this tendency to just resort to abject racial profiling in law enforcement.
Just less than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Eugene Hamilton. He is retired, just recently retired, as Chief Judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia and is now judge in senior status, meaning that he is still hearing cases. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois and is here to be honored along with some other alums by the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And certainly we welcome your questions. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One issue having to do with justice that's been up for discussion quite a bit here over the last couple of years, certainly here in the state of Illinois, but elsewhere, is the death penalty. It seems to be the case that there still is public support for capital punishment, generally speaking, in the United States, although it is something that's receiving a lot of discussion. And people seem to be concerned with the issue, not so much of capital punishment in the abstract, but the idea that if someone's going to be executed, we'd better be certain that we have the right person. I wonder whether you think whether we as a society are anywhere close to at least having a serious conversation about whether or not we continue to want to have capital punishment.
Well, I think the governor of the state of Illinois came down in exactly the right place on this issue. There's nothing theoretically wrong or objectionable to capital punishment as a concept. The problem is that before you put in place a system of capital punishment, you must have in place a system which provides competent representation by counsel, not just to some of the people who may be charged with a capital offense, but to everyone. And unless you have that system in place, and unless you're willing to pay for that system, then I don't think we're ready for capital punishment. And that's mm-hmm. the problem. It's appalling to me to see, to read about so many cases where people have been convicted of capital offenses who have been represented by inadequate counsel. And that hadn't got anything to do with whether a person is guilty or not guilty, how heinous the crime may have been. It just simply has to do with the fact that we are a country of laws. And that means that anybody who is charged with and tried for a very serious offense involving a capital offense must, without regard to ability to pay, be represented by competent counsel. Mm.
Well, I think certainly that in other places and here in the state of Illinois, when people have talked about what we might do, that indeed is what's come up for discussion. That is the idea that there ought to be a capital bar.
Yes.
That it should be that if you're going to be an attorney and you're going to represent someone who is eligible for the death penalty, you should be trained, experienced in those kind of cases. Perhaps there ought to be some sort of certification process. And then going further, there's this issue of providing people with resources to do forensic work, to hire people to do expert testimony, those sorts of things, particularly if your client does not have the means to provide that kind of money, so that then you can mount an adequate defense. The thing is, I think some people would say is that makes it sound as if we think the problem with the death penalty basically is a lawyering problem, that if somebody is wrongly convicted, it's a lawyering issue. It's not really an issue, a fundamental justice issue. Is it somehow both?
Well, it may be both, but I think what we have to do, based on the fact that we are a country of laws, of constitutional laws, we have to eliminate this lawyering factor from the equation, so that we're absolutely certain that the conviction was not based on inadequate representation by counsel, and all of the requirements that you training, experience, certification, the availability of resources, all of those things that you mentioned must be there so that we can eliminate this question of whether or not it resulted from inadequate representation by counsel. And then, that having been done, as I said, let the chips fall where they will or may.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think that we, you think if those issues that could be addressed, then the concerns that most people have about the death penalty would be addressed? We would.
I think so. I really do. I think most people are really repulsed by the notion that we're not really certain whether this person had adequate representation by counsel, because in many instances, the individuals that are providing this representation are inadequately trained. Some of them have professional responsibility problems themselves with the bar. Some of them have substance abuse problems. Some of them lack the resources, the infrastructure in their own practice, and so far as the forensics are concerned, to mount a competent defense. Not everybody has the money of an O.J. Simpson or some of the other people that have been mentioned in relation to capital cases, but every person who is charged in a capital offense ought to have the ability to mount the best defense that is available to that individual before they're convicted.
I wonder whether in some people's minds there continues to be an uncertainty about the sentence of life in prison, and that people don't really believe that means what it means. And if we could communicate to people that if you want to consider that option, we could guarantee if someone's convicted of murder, we sentence them to life in prison. That's what that means. That means that person will never step out the door again. They'll never be on the streets again. If we could make sure people understood that really is what it meant, I wonder whether you think that would influence people's feeling about the death penalty.
Well, I think it would, but I think really most people, underlying most people's apprehension or reluctance in the death penalty area is this question of adequate representation. Mm-hmm. I really think that's fundamental, and I would like to see that question put to rest. If we could just simply say that each person who is charged with a capital offense is guaranteed adequate representation by counsel. That being the case, then I think there are a lot of people who should be charged and convicted of capital offenses and suffer the ultimate punishment.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say to our guest, Eugene Hamilton, retired chief judge in senior status from the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. Judge Hamilton, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you, David.